Hey, Renter Retires, it's Adam Schrader here with another episode, joined as usual by Zach Lee Master, the founder and CEO of Renter Retirement. And we have a very special guest for you today. He is the president of Bigger Pockets. His name is Scott Trench. He's also the author of a new book that he's coming out with, and that is Set for Life, Dominate Life, Money, and the American Dream. Scott, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me, Adam. It's great to be here.
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, a lot of our people come from Bigger Pockets. They've probably heard of you, but they probably don't have any clue how you actually got into real estate. So let's start off and just ask, how did you end up in the real estate world? What was the first deal you ever took part in?
Yeah, so I started my career as a financial analyst at a Fortune 500 company. I was making $48,000 a year. And I looked around and I was like, wow, you know, if I kick butt, I'm going to graduate to financial analyst two, then financial analyst three, then finance manager, senior finance manager, finance director, senior finance director, VP of finance and CFO over a 25-year period. And that's been really good. And that's not really what I want. And so it took me about 3 months to realize that. And I became obsessed, is probably the right word, with the concept of financial independence and early retirement, the FIRE movement, financial independence, retire early. And I became a really big fan of a blog of a local Coloradan named Mr. Money Mustache. Which is all about frugality, badassity, and, you know, keeping your expenses very low so you can save as much of that income as possible and invest it. And I also paired that with another podcast and website blog forum called Bigger Pockets. And so I really kind of tried to marry those two concepts together of being very, very frugal, living on as little as I possibly could, bringing my lunch to work, biking to work, you know, keeping expenses low, and using those proceeds to then fund my first real estate investment. So after the first year, I'd saved up $20,000. I bought a house hack here in Denver, Colorado, a dumpy little property, two beds, one bath, flat roof, you know, worst house, okay neighborhood, and moved in, fixed it up, and still in that property today. It's been a huge winner and kind of got the career in real estate moving from there.
That's awesome, Scott, and thank you so much for sharing your introduction. I think a lot of people who are from the Bigger Pockets community are familiar with you and look at you as maybe someone who's like one of the many people we hear on the podcast, right, that have 1,000 doors, they've been investing forever, this huge real estate empire, and it's sometimes, I think, a little demotivating for people, or it's just like, man, I'm not there yet, I can't bridge the gap. A lot of people, at least with our audience, are looking to get into that first deal. They're looking to understand real estate and see that this is something that, you know, might be an additional stream of income for them, a side hustle, something along these lines, and they're trying to learn. I love hearing stories of people that, and I am a little bit more intricately familiar with your story through our conversations of, you know, you don't do all investing in real estate, right? You invest in multiple different things. You have a modest portfolio and you continue to invest in real estate and you surround yourself with other investors. I'm curious to hear about, let's talk about, okay, so you had the first house hack. Let me ask you this first. Do you think that house hacking, would you define that for us? And do you think that that is an easy entry point for a lot of people? Is that something you recommend starting to invest on?
Yeah. Well, look, I'd love to go back just a second here and tackle that, you know, mogul comment you made there about people with thousands of units with this. I have 13 units in 5 properties that I've accumulated over 10 years, right? There's nothing special about that journey in real estate. I've been very methodical. That's a property every 18 to 24 months, saving up, buying another one. I've lived in 3 of them with this. We'll talk about the house hacking point in a second here. You don't need a lot of capital to house hack properties. And I am starting to get beyond the typical real estate investor. The typical real estate investor in this country owns 1 or 2 properties outside their primary residence. There are 18 million plus or minus, you can, you know, a million or so, depending on who you ask, single family rentals in this country. And 60% of them are owned by people who have just 1 or 2 properties, and 90% of them are owned by investors with 10 or fewer properties. So the people on Bigger Pockets who are the loudest are the people who love real estate and talk about it all day long and go on to acquire dozens or hundreds of doors. That is not the typical real estate investor, though. The typical real estate investor is much more like me and even smaller with their portfolio.
Yeah, that's
right. Then you had another question. Point. You had a question you actually asked me that I did not answer. What was that?
So just on, and thank you for that, because I want to set the stage here too. We're very big advocates of real estate. Obviously, we're very biased and Adam and I are investors ourselves. But I always tell people, like, real estate, it can fit different goals for different people, right? You don't you don't necessarily need, or a lot of people don't want to be this have this huge rental empire, but you can make huge advances in your financial position and, you know, ultimately achieve a fair amount of financial freedom and generational wealth just with a handful of rentals if you intentionally invest over time, you know, but it may not be your goal to own 50 plus stores, and that's okay. You know, whatever starting point meets your goals. The point is that you're educating yourself and taking action. But Scott, I was going to ask you about house hacking. So that's basically where you live in part of the house. Like, you can buy 1 to 4 units using conventional financing where you can put a low down payment. That's a huge benefit to a lot of people because you can come in and buy a house as a primary residence. You do have to have the intention to live in the house where it can be a 1 to 4 unit. You can rent out additional rooms and do co-living in that house, or you can say buy a duplex. Same with me. I bought a duplex, lived in half, rented out the other half. I used a VA loan because I was military, where I put zero money down, and you can rinse and repeat, right? You can hold that as a rental, and that's a really easy entry point to real estate. But I wanted to ask, just like, do you recommend house hacking for people? It sounds like this was a little bit of your strategy in the beginning, where you had access to good loan structures, where you were able to acquire rentals. I'm assuming, well, I think you verified this, but you moved out of that first duplex and you kept that as a rental, right? And then rinse and repeat. I mean, talk to us a little bit more about house hacking and if that's something you recommend to people starting out.
Yeah, it's a cheat code. It's really hard to build wealth, I think, without house hacking, unless you earn a very high income or start a business, right? Like, it's just, if you're a middle-class American and you don't house hack, you're going to be stuck for a very, very long period of time, and really never be able to accumulate a lot of wealth until, you know, unless you allow the slow accumulation of compounding in your 401k, for example, to work its magic, and your house to slowly amortize where you're pouring in a mortgage payment. I'll give you an example. It's, you know, we can talk about the ROI, but I'll give you an example of my second purchase. Okay, I went out to purchase this property. I had made $48,000 a year my first year, maybe bumped it up to $65,000-$70,000 by the time I was looking for my second purchase. Okay, when I wanted to buy that next property, I called up my lender, and they said, "Hey, Scott, you have $75,000, but you also have this income on your tax return from your house hack that is qualifying you as a landlord here. And since you're looking to buy a quadplex here, you can use 75% of the projected rents from this quadplex to help you qualify for this." So that enabled me, I didn't do this, but I had the ability to get $1 million in financing. Now, if I had bought the same property I had as a house and didn't have any payments, there's a $240,000 duplex that I bought in 2014, that was my first property, right? If I bought that as a house, I probably wouldn't have been able to qualify for 50 grand because I would have had a mortgage payment and I wouldn't have had, and my debt to income would have been crushed. So it's just, I mean, not the house hack reduced my housing payment from $1,500 a month to basically zero at the time, you know, net of the mortgage payment, the CapEx, maintenance, utilities, all that kind of stuff, probably paying like $100 to live or something like that. So that's $1,500 a month in my pocket in perpetuity for as long as I'm living in the house hack. I'm amortizing the property just like a homeowner. I'm benefiting from appreciation just like a homeowner. I have the ability to move out at any time after that first year because I don't have a lease with myself, for example. I don't have to sell the property like a homeowner and figure out how to rent it. It is a rental property. So it's the ultimate flexibility. It gave me a tremendous amount of, it built a tremendous amount of wealth for me, and it set up the next phase of real estate investing. And so it's just like that one decision, you can like almost do the alternative path for me. I'm stuck in that house and maybe until today, maybe I swap it out and upgrade to a different one. But the only way to get out of that cycle and break out of it is to let decades move by or to blow up your life and downsize back into a house hack, for example, which is not something that you want to do in your 30s with the family, most likely. So I think it's like almost, you really got to do something else very right to overcome not house hacking if you want to get wealthy and achieve financial independence early in life in this country.
When you were house hacking, and then especially when you moved out into your second house hack, were you self-managing and letting the people know that you were the owner? Or did you pretend like you were the property manager? And then when you moved out, did you get one? How did you manage these properties as you grew to, you know, 5 properties, 13 doors, while also, oh, by the way, having a job along the way?
So property management, there's an interweaving set of challenges around property management and risk and asset protection that I think are underlying your question there. And so first, from a risk management perspective, a lot of landlords like to put their properties in LLCs, right? Those types of things. for a house hacker, you know, and everyone, you could talk to your attorney and all that kind of stuff. But for a house hacker, for Scott Trench, back then I had 20 grand. I put 12 of it into the property. So protecting my $8,000 in remaining net worth from a lawsuit is not a smart move from an to form an LLC or whatever, or try to separate myself from the business of this. Further, it would be very difficult to separate myself from liability from the business while living in the house hack, because I'm living in the property, right? Try to, you know, give the attorney the opportunity to pierce the corporate veil there. There is no protection, or at least I perceive there's very little protection for me as a house hacker in putting the property into an LLC. Furthermore, to remove that protection, you need to not self-manage the property, right? And so if you're self-managing the property, then there's also a potential risk of piercing the corporate veil because you're involved in it. So to me, it felt very silly to attempt to do any form of asset protection, like putting the property in LLC while living in a house hack with very little net worth outside of the house hack. So I self-managed, and last, my dollar value of my time at that point was $48,000 per year, or $24 per hour, if you assume a 2,000-hour work year. So property management is worth more than $24 an hour. You're likely going to pay more than $24 an hour for ongoing property management in most markets, especially higher price point ones like Denver. So to me, for all those reasons, it just is so obvious to manage property myself. Plus, I'm living in the property. If a tenant has a problem, I just go over there after work. And it's not like I have to drive across town. So I think house hackers, especially those starting out, there's a lot of overwhelming reasons to go ahead and, you know, self-manage that property there. And I wasn't shy. I'm the owner, and here's how we run things and all that kind of stuff. So I found that to be valuable education as well. Over time, as years progressed, the dollar value of my time grew because the house hack generated a lot of wealth, right? The next property went there. My career advanced, and I joined Bigger Pockets as an employee, and Bigger Pockets grew, and I became president and CEO over the years. And so maybe 4 or 5 years ago, I felt that the value of my time and the fact that my portfolio had begun to spread out eclipsed the point where it was worthwhile for me to manage the properties. So I now have a property manager for all the properties except for the duplex, a new duplex that I live in currently, because it's just so easy to manage somebody who's next door.
Yeah, that's fantastic. Thanks for sharing the philosophy on management. I think that's probably the most common case. I mean, yeah, it makes sense to self-manage if you're house hacking. I remember I self-managed for a long time, certainly all the house hacks that I did in early on. And I love that you quantified your time value, right? I mean, a lot of people, even down to the hour, I don't think a lot of people really realize that, but it's okay to self-manage right out of the gates. In my personal experience, I realized that I was not a good property manager because I became too friendly with tenants and I let them.
Well, I learned that too, don't worry. Yeah.
So we all have those stories, right? Like you give a mouse a cookie or whatever, you know, I think Brandon used to say, you know, where you allow them a little bit of leniency and then they take advantage of that. But I also had some tenants that, hey, I still keep in touch with today and help them. But let's back up a little bit even further, Scott, because I really want to get inside your investor head. You're running Bigger Pockets right now, which is the number one really online community for real estate investors. And you teach a lot of people. We sat in on your recent webinar, which I want to talk about how to get started investing. A lot of that was mindset. We'll talk about your book, Set for Life, which, by the way, it's not an up and coming book. This is a book that you've written years ago at this point, right? So, but this is something we want to dive into as well. But I want to get inside your head a little bit to talk about just the mindset of like, why real estate? So you were in the financial space already. You were conscious about being a savvy investor and thinking about finances in your future. But like, why real estate? There's a lot of different things you can invest in. What attracted you to real estate, and what gave you the bug to still continue to invest heavily in real estate?
Well, I think real estate has a number of advantages, especially for someone getting started in the wealth building journey. One is the house hack, right? The house hack math is a no-brainer. You can very easily get to a 200%+ IRR in the early years because of the crazy amount of leverage that you can use in a house hack, and acknowledge that you're taking no more risk than the homeowners who are using 5% down, you know, 3.5% to 5% down payments on primary residences, and you have the added risk reduction of having part of the mortgage covered. So really the house hack was just, like, you can't really put together a financial model for any other investment that comes anywhere close to the power that can have on your financial position. So that was the reason you get into it. And then once you learn all the ropes of how to manage tenants and underwrite the property and make sure it works long term, now you have the skill set to invest in real estate. And you know, real estate is not a way to drive a 25 or 30% return on investment, at least not the way what I call investing. The business of real estate, you know, of really rehabbing properties and improving their value, taking them from X to Y, and building the machine of adding value, the work of contracting, basically, but owning the property or managing the contractors, that's a way to drive really good returns. But no, that's a business. The investing I do, I think it's a, you know, mid-teens way, a type of return that you can expect over a long period of time, mostly because of the leverage and the long-term bet on appreciation of U.S. housing stock, or specifically Denver housing stock, which is my specific bet here. So I believe those things. And I think if you convince yourself, like I have, that Denver is going to have a 3 to 4, maybe a little bit higher long-term average appreciation rate because of constraints on supply, because it's a wonderful place to live. Constraints on supply involving water. We don't have a lot of water out here on the East Coast. They have a lot of water, but they don't have a lot of land. So, you know, those are the things that drove me to it. The other part of it is it's semi-passive, right? So what that does is that allows you, when your time value is very low, to save costs and do high dollar per hour work, self-managing or fixing up the property. And when your value of time hopefully increases, you can begin outsourcing those things and, you know, still drive reasonable returns. So I liked that those things. And last, it's not a business, right? Or at least it isn't, you know, there's a business aspect to it, but it's a semi-passive investing activity. And so there's a very small time allocation I can put towards it per month, so I can pursue my career full time. So those are the reasons why I really like real estate over other asset classes.
Yeah, I think and thank you for breaking that down. Real estate attracts a lot of people because you can very well start it as a side hustle, right? And for some people that becomes full-time hustle, but it's very attainable for someone to come in. And there's a lot of different things you can do investing in real estate. I mean, that's the beautiful thing about real estate. Sometimes puts you at a disadvantage because you get the shiny object syndrome and there's too much. But once you decide on a path to start on, I mean, it very much can be a side hustle where you can educate yourself. You can still have your job where you're earning good income, qualify for loans to be able then to acquire more assets and learn the ropes, and then decide as you become a more experienced investor how involved you want to be. Talk to us a little bit about your journey with Bigger Pockets. I mean, as I mentioned, a big portion of our audience is familiar with Bigger Pockets, possibly comes from Bigger Pockets because we do so much with you guys. I'm really curious. So, I mean, it was it real estate that led you to then get a job at Bigger Pockets, and how did you advance and excel to become the CEO and president of Bigger Pockets? Just give us that journey.
Yeah. So as a fan of Bigger Pockets, a couple weeks ago, looked back and saw my first forum post on Bigger Pockets, which was May of 2014. I said I was going to buy 3 properties by the end of 2014. I did not achieve that goal. But I did get an inbound response from an agent who helped me buy that next property in response to that post. Anyway, so I was a fan of Bigger Pockets, joined the community, and followed the advice on the podcast of meeting with local investors. I actually joined a free local mastermind of folks who like to meet on Thursday mornings at 7 o'clock and talk about real estate investment activities. I had no business being there. I had no experience in real estate, but they allowed me to tag along as this 23-year-old, very eager kid. And I took each of them out to lunch. One of them happened to work in the same co-working space as the founder of Bigger Pockets, Josh Dorkin. And so in July of 2014, maybe that was May, April, something around that, May, April, June, was when I actually met him for the first time. I bugged him to work for him on the weekends or whatever. I couldn't tell you what I was thinking at that point in time, other than like, something's going on. This company is great. They're doing real things here. I'm a huge fan. It's changing my life. You know, I'm doing all the things they're saying. And I just offered to work for him for free. And he basically said, no. He remembers it differently, but I remember something to the effect of, no, go away, kid, you're bothering me. And so I followed up 6 more times, and then he hired me as the director of operations, at that time the 3rd employee in the company. So the director title was very lofty, but it also meant things like keeping the books, grabbing coffee and lunch, and, you know, revenue, and those types of things. So it was kind of an interesting ride there. It was very startup vibe for those first couple of years while I was there. It was Josh, Brandon, and I were the true full-time employees working at the business. There were other people that were there. doing part-time work or had been working as a contractor. And then we just kind of got 1% bigger or better or improved or add something on every week for the last 9 years, right? There's never been like a, whoa, this kind of thing exploded. It's just been a steady progression, right? Puts and takes. This is going up, this is going down, but the overall level of people that we're reaching and helping with real estate or the products that we're offering or the engagement with the platform overall just creeps up a little bit as we kind of fine tune operations or whatever. So that's been the journey in a nutshell.
Do you come from a family who has some real estate investing background, or was it just the community that you found kind of mostly online and some in the morning? Because I know some people, myself included, don't come from a real estate investing background. Their family doesn't. My family still doesn't understand what we're doing. The support isn't really there from them. So it's really all about, you know, the investors I talk to, all of those things. So was yours from the beginning and at home you were supported, or was yours through the real estate groups and Bigger Pockets?
No, my parents lived in the same house, still live in the same house that I was born in 33 years ago. That my dad did own one rental property with my grandma, but it was not a major part of the portfolio. And, you know, I think if you asked him, he would say that it was a pain in his rear. It never really did much. So yeah, that was not a part of my upbringing. And, you know, another thing is, you know, my parents have both had fantastic careers. My mom was a nurse for 40 years at Johns Hopkins. And my dad's been an engineer at a very well-respected company in out of Washington, D.C., Alexandria, Virginia. They both did the same career for 40 years there. And I, you know, after 6 months in the job, was like, I want to quit my job and retire early. So, you know, I was like, I want to go in a completely different direction. Now, here I am 10 years, approaching my 10-year anniversary at Bigger Pockets, doing exactly the same thing as my parents. So, you know, that to go figure.
Well, I would say a lot more, right? Like you have more than that one house that is a pain in the neck. But
in terms of career, like the real thing was like the career. Like I was as the you know, punk kid, I wanted to do something totally different than the 40-year at the same company thing. Now I'm here. Yeah, 10 years, loving it. So yeah.
No, that's great. Talk to us about Scott, the vision of Bigger Pockets. Has a mission statement changed? Has a vision changed? I've been a member around the same time as you. I think maybe 2015 was when I first joined, and was, you know, obviously love the community. We'll get into some advice that you have for new aspiring guys, maybe some other people that are in that same position you were 10 years ago. I want to hear from you about that. But first, talk to us about Bigger Pockets as a whole, and like, what's the goal? What are you guys trying to accomplish? What is the mission that you are putting out publicly, and what does the next 10 years look like?
Yeah, look, our purpose is to help ordinary people build wealth through real estate. So the long-term goal is to help 1 million people reach accredited investor status through net worth through real estate. It's 1 million millionaires, right? We like that goal better than helping one person achieve $1 trillion net worth, because we think that as you help people, and look, I'm also biased here, as you help people achieve financial independence, and especially early in life, potential unlocks in pretty incredible ways. So, you know, if someone is 30 and financially independent, they have the opportunity to start many businesses, nonprofits, you know, go on and run for president or whatever it is, in a way that potentially does a lot of good downstream for society, because they're able to pursue their highest and best use, whatever they imagine that to be. And that's beneficial for everyone up and down the chain. But it's really helping folks achieve that goal as early as possible in life, and help it and expand it. And I think if you create 1 million folks with those types of outcomes, or participate a little bit in their journeys, good things will happen downstream. And we see a number of examples of that over the years that have been pretty fun.
Yeah, you guys have clearly had an impact on a lot of people's lives, myself included, and you know, a lot of people within our company and our organization as well. Give us a fun story. Put you on the spot here. What's the coolest thing or the funnest thing that you've been able to be a part of or witness from Bigger Pockets over your decade of involvement?
Let me think about it. I'll start off with an example of a user here. So we had a woman named Stacy. She's out of Pennsylvania. Stacy's a veterinarian. Veterinarians graduate medical or veterinarian school with basically doctor medical school like debt. But their average starting salary is $70,000 or $80,000 a year. So it's one of the worst financial starts you can get. And her and her husband built a real estate portfolio, became financially free, refinanced one of the properties to pay off the student loan debt. And now she works for an organization that helps fund veterinarian education so that vets do not start as deeply in that hole. It's like, okay, that's a pretty cool example of how Bigger Pockets, you know, we did not set out to save the horses here. That's not our stated mission, but that's the type of impact that folks can begin to have as they achieve their goals through real estate. So is that what you're kind of asking? And I guess the other one is kind of like a business moment where we were really excited.
No, that's a fun story for sure, where you're having that ripple effect, right, on people's lives that are now going out and changing other people's lives. If you have any other, you know, fun business stories or just interesting things over the past, we'd love to hear them too. We're putting you on the spot here and not prepping you for this, but.
Well, I got a million of them, but one of the highlights of the whole career here was the conference we had just a few months ago in Orlando. I mean, we had our biggest conference ever with, I think, 2,600 attendees. And, you know, it's in the middle of this year where there's a lot of question marks around real estate, interest rates spiked, but there was a bunch of people who, you know, were thriving, had a large number of success stories, were talking about how they built portfolios over the years and how much, you know, Bigger Pockets have been a part of that journey. And it was like that concept I told you, it's been 1% bigger every week for 10 years. And you look out over the sea of people at the opening event, I'm shaking in my pants, you know, talking in front of this live crowd there. And I'm like, whoa, like, how do we get here? You know, that's kind of one of those pretty special moments. So.
Absolutely. You mentioned at the beginning of your journey, you follow the Mr. Money Mustache, you know, squirrel away everything you can, eat cheap and, you know, save up your money that way. You obviously big part of the Bigger Pockets Money podcast. What advice or things have you heard on that podcast that have really set you, you know, have kind of struck you as, oh man, this is a really good thing to do, or I think more people should be doing this.
I think that all investing begins with the fundamentals of having cash to invest, right? There needs to be a generation of cash and the accumulation of cash so that you can invest. You know, for me, real estate investing is I put my own dollars in and then allow real estate appreciation and amortization and cash flow to benefit me, right? That's what I see as investing. And to do that, the way I've done that, the way I got here and the way I'll continue to build my wealth is by spending less than I earn in a very fundamental sense. And that is not very exciting to a lot of people, but that's just how it goes. And I worry, you know, I see a lot of folks around the real estate community, and we talk about this a lot in Bigger Pockets. There's lots of ways to be successful with this that try to put capital together from six different sources to create a deal. To me, that's not investing. That's a job, right? I run Bigger Pockets, and I try to drive returns for shareholders at Bigger Pockets, right? I have a job in order to do that as CEO. And I think the same thing's going on with a lot of those investments. And that's the biggest fundamental is if you want to get rich long-term, like, you know, you can do those types of things, but ultimately you got to spend less than you're bringing in a pretty meaningful way and accumulate those assets that you own long-term. And I think some people don't love to hear that answer, but it's just the reality of how wealth is built in this country.
It's not the most sexy answer, right? It's like, I can't get rich immediately overnight. Like so many people are preaching to me online to join their course. I mean,
here's an example, right? I was talking to a friend a while back, and you know, they're like, they make a lot of money. And they're like, well, the answer for me getting wealthier is for me to make more money and keep driving my career. And they were paying like a ton of money on rent or whatever it was. And I was like, well, look, I view it completely differently. Like if you just like didn't spend this much on rent and you spent, you know, $3,000 a month instead of what you're spending, now you accumulate $50,000, $60,000, $70,000 more per year after tax with which to invest. Oh, and by the way, you no longer need to generate $100,000 in passive cash flow in order to fund the lifestyle that you currently are living there. So it's just this like incredible it's almost double trouble the more that you spend because you accumulate less, and generating $1,000 a month in passive cash flow is hard, right? That's $12,000 a year. And then there's a 4% rule multiplier, right? So that's 12,000 times 25. That's 300 grand. So that $1,000 a month expense is a $300,000 pile of wealth that you need to accumulate, another $300,000 pile of wealth that you need to accumulate in order to achieve financial freedom. It just makes the game very, very hard. And so I think that's the biggest takeaway. People don't love that because they all want to drive fancy cars and, you know, fly around in private jets and, you know, live on the beach or whatever it is, but it's just not how it goes for most people.
Yeah, call it the lifestyle creep, right? Where you're always on that chasing the next carrot and earning more. But and to your point on the math, I mean, if you look at one of the reasons we love rental real estate from a passive nature is in a lot of cases, in most cases, if you know, the cash flow that you earn from your passive income is taxless, right? You have a lot of write-offs to offset that. That could be the equivalent of a 30 to 50% more, you know, more money from earned income. It's just playing the game smart. And so I appreciate you breaking down that math, Scott. Just to plug the Bigger Pockets Conference real quick, which we've been a part of every single year you guys have done this. I think it's been 4 years, right? Correct me if I'm wrong.
Yeah, but thank you, by the way, for being a part of it and for sponsoring us.
Yeah, well, we enjoy being around other people. This is one of the most important things. If you go back to listen to what Scott said in the very beginning, what attributed to his success on his path was forcing himself into these situations, even though he didn't feel like he was deserving or wasn't comfortable with being around other investors. Like, you made it a point to get up early to go to these 7 a.m. meetings, right? And surround yourself, even the fact that you were joining Bigger Pockets, you're surrounding yourself by people that you can learn from.
And by the way, the guys loved it. Like, they were like, this kid is biking across town so that he could save money to buy real estate. Like, that's serious. Like, they really appreciated that. So, you know.
And I know you had to knock on Josh's door a few times before he gave you the opportunity, but I mean, I think that a lot of people that are further ahead, if you can show them the initiative, right, and the drive, instead of just like, what can you do for me? If you can show up and show them that you're sincere and motivated and hungry, like, they want to help you. People want to give back and pass on their knowledge. That's self-fulfilling for them and rewarding, right? They see probably a younger version of themselves. And so we have a lot of people that will reach out and say, like, the mindset is different, where it's like, what can you do for me? Right. But I think in the early years, you just have to have that hunger. I mean, is there any pieces of advice, Scott, you would give to someone that is in your shoes 10 years ago that wants to learn about real estate, wants to get into real estate, but maybe doesn't have enough money yet? They're hungry, but they don't know what to do yet. What can they do?
Accumulate cash, right? Go work extra hours, you know, go cut your costs, pack your lunch, accumulate cash, right? You want to do a real estate deal? Put down 5% on a house hack. How do you get 5%? Spend a year driving for Uber, like I did, right? Packing your lunch, whatever, and putting in the work, and you will reap the rewards for the remaining 70, 80, if you're lucky, years of your life, 50 to 80 years of your life, depending on how lucky you are, on how well you take care of yourself, right? Like it's just that simple to me. I think that there are other ways. You'll always hear success stories. You'll find them at Bigger Pockets. The world's a big place, but less than, you know, a tiny percentage of people are going to just kind of are going to figure out some sort of, you know, some sort of way to put together some big deal out of the gate and be a part of it. It's the path to success is accumulation and snowball of wealth 1 month at a time and increasing it by a couple percentage points each month for a long period of time. At least that's my view.
You mentioned back in 2014, you saw the post about acquiring Three Doors in that year. And then obviously you met the agent, but you didn't hit that Three Doors in a year. As you set your goals and you didn't hit them, how did you adjust your strategy? How did you get over the potentially feeling like some people, they set their goals, they don't hit them. They're like, oh, I'm a failure. Obviously I'm not going to be able to do this long-term. How did you get over the fact that you didn't hit your Three Doors and adjust moving forward?
I was just happy to get a deal. Once the facts of life were explained to me by a lender, That was no longer an issue of like, oh, that was just like a stupid goal. Not a stupid goal, but like not a practical one, at least not if you want to own the deal. And like, what are you going to do? Raise $200,000 in equity from a variety of other people when you have $20,000 and 1 year of experience to your name and put together more deals? Like, no, you're going to go live in the house hack and own the whole thing, with this, you know? And so I thought that was pretty easy. I will say I also did build my early portfolio. I brought in a partner, one of my good friends. And so we pulled together on that, but it wasn't like raising capital from a bunch of different sources. We both put in equal amounts of cash as we scaled the portfolio But yeah, it's like that, it was as simple as that. On the goal setting piece though, one big item there is I had a neighbor growing up named Adam, and Adam was he built a very successful contracting business. And one of the things Adam did really well was set goals. And I remember he showed me one of them and I thought it was so cheesy. It was this kind of like, some sort of coaching program or whatever with this. And he had a book called Living Your Best Year Ever, which I thought was a big pile of cheese from Darren Hardy, who's a success guru. And you know, after a while, when I wasn't getting anywhere, kind of my last year of college and early in my career, I just kind of adopted a mindset change. I said, I'm going to embrace the cheesiness of this goal setting process here and the living your best year ever. So I bought one of these books. I signed a pledge to myself on the first page that said I'm going to stick to my goals. And then I just executed the book. And guess what? 9 years later, I'm still doing the cheesy self-help book from Darren Hardy. I paid the guy $400 in journals over the last 10 years. And it's like, look, his system's great. There's plenty of systems out there, but the fact that there's like a weekly mechanism to track, like, here are my big priorities this week, here are the habits. I've been doing that not every week, but probably 85, 90% of weeks for the last 10 years. And that I think has helped me kind of get better at goal setting and more realistic. You know, no one's realistic the first time you set goals. It's the process of refining it over a long period of time that I think helps you get stronger at it.
Well, this is huge.
$400 well spent.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Mean. Yeah. And not only that, I probably bought this book for another 30 people over the years. I'm sure, you know, two of them can use it. But yeah, you know, folks always get interested in it. I said, you know, go check this out. This is it. Now my wife does it with me too. So
I love that.
We've been very good supporters of the Darren Hardy program. I also email him once a year. He's never responded to me about the progress I make in my journey. So one of these days he'll get it.
That's okay. That's the self-validation. You know, I think that the most important thing I heard you say is that you made goals, right? And you wrote them down. And we always talk about writing your goals down, but then also
telling Darren Hardy is not cheesy at all. I just thought that it was cheesy when I started. So I that was my mindset going in. It was like, this self-help stuff is kind of crap. Sorry. Yeah.
Well, and now you're a true believer in it, and it's become a daily routine, right? And that's important, having healthy habits like that, setting goals, telling people about them, possibly accountability partners, holding yourself accountable. And you've incorporated that into your daily life over the past so many years. I mean, that's great, Scott. And it's cool to see you continue to do that. We are when this will be released, this will be in January of 2024. This is an interesting time to talk about goals because this is very near to a lot of people's hearts, trying to set either New Year's resolutions or goals for 2024. Like, hey, this is the year. There's been a lot of people over the past 2 years that have maybe, you know, let the market be a challenge to them, looked at interest rates, some turmoil. I mean, there's always something going on in the world, by the way. I mean, we talk about this a lot, but like you'll always find an excuse or reason not to accomplish your goals or invest if that's what you're looking for. But being that this is going to be released in January, what are some recommendations besides maybe doing the exact same thing that you're doing with journaling and like writing down goals? You know, maybe speak to the webinar that you are presenting recently where you talked about how to get started investing. What are some pieces of advice or recommendations you have for someone on how to be successful in 2024? And feel free to just, if you want to put in some information about like where you think the market is or not even talk about that, but like, what are some action steps for people in 2024 from Scott Trench?
You know, it's always the fundamentals, right? So, you know, start with the cheesy stuff, right? Like go type out a draft vision. If it's just you, call it your vision. Like, what do you want your day-to-day to look like? Where do you want to live? What do you want to look at when you wake up out the morning? What do you want your activity set on the weekday and the weekend to be, right? you don't have to buy some like expensive program. Just type it on a piece of paper. If you are married or have a partner, put the word draft right in front of that title.
It'd be an editable version. Yeah.
Because if you provide a vision and that is not aligned, you will have the opportunity to rise it together. I did that on my honeymoon, by the way, which people find funny or perhaps in character on this. So, and then if you have one, iterate on it once a year or once a quarter, because it should change, and it will stop moving after 3 or 5 years in a big way, but it will move the first year or two as long as you're iterating on it. Then think about like, okay, what do I need to do to get there from a long-term perspective? What do I need to do here in 2024? And these goals, like they never really are like something kind of secret sauce or whatever. It's just an accountability component, and they need to be trackable and something that you can work on a regular basis and collect data around, right? They almost always, in people I talk to at least, boil down to some sort of career goal. I'm gonna write a book. I'm gonna enact this strategy. I'm gonna move this number. I'm gonna launch this new product, whatever it is. There's almost always health, right? If you're not focusing on your health, what are you doing, right? And that comes down to working out. I think the 80-20 of health is working out, right? If I'm working out and I eat like crap, I'm still looking good and having high energy. If I'm eating well but not working out, I feel like crap. So that is almost always there. Certain other folks might have that differently. And then of course there's your family. And how you want your lifestyle to be led. And for me, the word there is proactivity. How often am I being proactive in making sure that we're manufacturing joy or wonderful experiences for the family? So everyone's different on that. But most goal setting falls into categories like that, I think, for most people in this country. And so it's just simple as then saying, what do I do? What am I going to do? What's the most important thing that I can do this quarter, boiling it down to 1 to 3 objectives. Three is what I usually settle on, and making weekly progress towards them. So it's just a matter of doing it. Everyone knows that they should probably be doing something like that. It's just a matter of actually sitting down and executing.
And doing, right? The easy part is writing down the goals. But a lot of the concepts that you've talked about, Scott, I think are reflected in your book, Set for Life. And we'd love to talk about, like, what is that book? What is it about? And, you know, what are the core concepts and who should read it? Can you talk to us about Set for Life?
Yeah, Set for Life is written for kind of the, you know, early, you know, 20s, maybe early 30s person just getting started on the road to wealth. I wrote it from the perspective of how does somebody with a median income and no assets, and also no debts, was the avatar. How does that person go from a standing start to financial freedom in as rapid a time period as possible, without having to start a business, for example, right? So that's the concept, right? Middle class worker, how do you go from zero to financial freedom as rapidly as possible? And there's three phases: the accumulation of the first $25,000, which is the hardest one, and how do you do it? Is scrimping and saving and hard work, and it's a grind, probably for about a year, in most cases. Then how do you go from $25,000 to $100,000? I like the combination of house hacking and then changing up the career to go into something that offers some sort of upside. And to get that upside, you have to give up something, which is usually the base salary, right? So that's usually a transition into some kind of sales or some kind of role that has less certainty, equity upside, whatever, that goes along with it, right? Like a career as an agent, for example, or mortgage broker. You're going to give up your $50,000 salary or median salary, and you're going to have the opportunity in exchange for that. How can you do that? Well, because you're house hacking and because you have a big pile of cash that you spend a year grinding to accumulate. And then last to come is the 100,000 to financial freedom. That's where you work to scale a scalable career and invest mechanistically on a continuous basis, growing that, you know, that monthly cash flow 1% a year, whatever it is, 1% a month, you know, just bit by bit by bit by piling it into, in my case, index funds and real estate. But there are plenty of other alternatives that folks could pursue at that point. Your options really multiply along the journey to financial independence. So it's fairly clear what to do if you're starting out at the very beginning. It's less clear what to do when you have $500,000 in wealth, because you have so many options.
let's talk about the options real quick that you're talking about, because you wrote an article for Bigger Pockets that I think is an important one for people to take a look at. And that is waiting for a great deal can be a huge waste of time. And this is something that kind of Zach was alluding to. We have a lot of people who have told us over the past year, oh, homes are too expensive, or oh, interest rates are too high. I'm going to wait for interest rates to come down. But then shockingly, interest rates come down, prices go up, and they don't do anything. So tell us a little bit about kind of what you covered whenever you were saying that waiting for a great deal is a huge waste of time.
I think the time to buy real estate is when your personal financial position allows you to do it very, very comfortably, right? You have the down payment, you have plenty of reserves left over. The cash has been set aside for a long period of time for that express purpose. And of course you want to get the best deal you can when you're purchasing it. But wealth in real, I'll use my that duplex I talked about earlier, right? I bought that place for $240 in 2014, right? It is now worth probably over $500,000 nine years later. And yes, there was great timing in the market, right? But if I had bought that place for $235, there's the return profile, the difference in the returns is meaningless, right? That extra $5,000. If I had lost the deal for $5,000 and waited another 6 months, that might have been very meaningful for me. If I bought the place for $275 and overpaid by $35,000, also meaningless, right? Because the property is appreciated so much and the debt is amortized. So, you know, we're all for getting a good deal, but it's like the 90-10 of the return profile is holding on to the thing for a decade or two or three. That's the 90% of your returns are going to come from that. And the next, I'll call it the 70% is going to come from that. The next 20% is going to come from how well you operate it, right? If I hadn't allowed a certain disastrous chain of events to allow me to go from highly qualified tenant to highly qualified tenant's highly qualified boyfriend to highly qualified tenant's boyfriend, okay qualified tenant, new girlfriend to girlfriend stays, and now very poorly qualified boyfriend comes in, and I'm left with a poorly qualified boyfriend, have disastrous chance. Yeah, if I didn't allow that chance, that thing to take place, I'd be up $30,000 on my deal, which is way more than the actual spread I would have gotten on the deal, the purchase price at the time back in 2014. So it's like this management, management is the next 20%, and then it's the purchase price. So it's like, yeah, go get a good deal if you can get one, right? There's no point in you'd be foolish not to try to save $3,000 to $5,000, but it's just not the game. The game is what can you buy? Is the market long-term going to appreciate? Can you operate in the upper quintile or quartile over that hold period? And then, yeah, are you getting a reasonable price on the thing at the end of it? So that's my thing. I think people spend way too much time focusing on the deal and not on the actual decade or decades long bet that they're fundamentally making when they purchase rental property.
Yeah, focusing on, and we deal with this a lot with newer investors. A lot of our investors are getting into that first deal, first out-of-state deal, or maybe it's like, they're under 10 doors. And they're so hyper concentrated on the pro forma, right? And like, where is this at today? And there's almost this disconnect, and we do try to like educate on, is this a good market? A lot of what we do is in the Southeast, which I would argue is a growth area. But it's like, where's this house going to be in 10 or 15, 20 years? As you mentioned, real estate over time is what creates wealth. And sometimes, like, especially with higher interest rates, that's a variable at one point in time, right? What I heard from you, Scott, is that you focused on what important about when we talk about the market and timing is a individual situation. Your timing is appropriate to you when you have the financial position to make a comfortable investment. And then you get to choose what investment you want to make, and you have to make it and hold on to it and operate it long term. But it's less about, let me time the market. We interview a lot of very successful people, and I've never heard someone actually say, I timed the market appropriately, right? It's, hey, I bought in good areas, I operated well or had good managerial teams, and then I continue to do that, rinse and repeat. It's no secret sauce here. And I let time develop my wealth over time. And then, of course, they maximize tax benefits and things like that. But
now, critical to what I just said, though, is this financial foundation, the fact that I'm saving a lot, and the fact that I can hold on to the property forever, right? So my portfolio has been very carefully and slowly accumulated relative to what I could have done. I worry, and I've seen a lot of people over the last 9-10 years race past me with their real estate portfolios, accumulating dozens, hundreds, or thousands of units. And so my game only works if you can actually hold on to the property for those decades. And that's I think a little bit of a warning shot for folks here is like, I think there's a lot of people who got much wealthier, much faster than me in real estate over the last 10 years. And there's gonna be a lot of people who are getting very much poorer than me, much faster in real estate over the next couple of years as well, because you know there's gonna be a change in prices. And if your approach does not allow you to hold the property forever, then you're gonna find yourself in trouble. So you cannot do what I'm talking about and just buy. It has to be whenever your personal financial position is ready, because that's the 70% of the bet that we're talking about.
Excellent advice there, Scott. So thank you for that. You were the co-host of The Money Show, or The Money Podcast on Bigger Pockets. Talk to us about that. What's that about? Why should people listen to you?
Well, that's where I harp on the personal financial foundation that we just talked about for hours and hours and hours every week on an ongoing basis. It's for folks that kind of share that mentality of like, I'm going to gradually and consistently increase my savings rate. I'm going to deploy that to thoughtful investments on a continuous basis. I'm going to remind myself that there are lots of other people out there who are doing this just like me, even though my family and friends might not be pursuing that. And we're going to hear from stories about folks that, you know, I think the mindset of money that's a little different from the Bigger Pockets Real Estate Podcast is I'm trying to achieve enough and then call it a day here. We're not trying to become billionaires on Bigger Pockets Money. We're trying to reach financial independence, in the 1 to 2.5, maybe to $5 million range in a reasonably rapid period of time so that you can enjoy the time that you want, that you're buying with that early financial independence.
You mentioned kind of investing as you have the money and it's secure there. You are obviously a big part of Bigger Pockets, and there's a lot of different ways.
Yeah, and I have to go in 1 minute, guys. I'm so sorry. Yeah.
So just final real quick question. How have you avoided shiny object syndrome?
My goal setting book, right? It forces some sort of simple mechanism. Like every week, there are three main goals, right? Here are my big goals for the quarter. Here are my big goals for the month. Big goal number one, what am I doing this week? Big goal number two, what am I doing this week? Big goal number three, what am I doing this week? Oh, and here's the vortex. Got to file the tax, whatever it is. Pick up the mail, right? Fix the sink. So, but like it forces me to focus on the three most important things and put everything else into the vortex, and then just consistent execution of that. So, and business, same deal. You can use a system like the Four Disciplines of Execution, or you can use a system like EOS. I just encourage entrepreneurs not to build their own systems at first. Maybe if you do it after you've executed an existing one, go build your own after that. But the systems all do kind of the same thing, which is to force prioritization to the most important things if it's a good goal setting system.
Fantastic. Well, Scott, thank you so much for joining us. The book for everybody, if you want to check it out, is Set for Life, Dominate Life, Money, and the American Dream. You can check us out at renttoretirement.com to start acquiring the properties as you're ready. That's at renttoretirement.com. You can book a call with us there. And as always, if you have any questions and you want them answered on the show, email them to podcast@renttoretirement.com. That's podcast@renttoretirement.com. Scott, again, thank you so much for joining us today. And to all our listeners, thanks for taking the time to educate yourselves. And we'll talk to you on the next episode.
Thanks so much, guys. Really appreciate it.